in a spherical harmonic basis by this set of coefficients ALM, then our standard cosmological model predicts that ALM is a statistical quantity. Each ALM is an independent Gaussian random variable with an L-dependent variance CL that depends on cosmological parameters. So a measurement of this power spectrum is the main measurement. The physics of how this power spectrum depends on cosmological parameters is very interesting, and one could give an entire talk just on that. But I mainly want to talk about other things, so I'll just give an example just to give the flavor of it. If we vary omega lambda, the fraction of the universe's energy density in vacuum energy, then that just shifts the acoustic peaks without changing the shape, the peak heights, the shape of the power spectrum. The reason for that is that if we vary omega lambda, we're keeping the lambda kicks in only at low redshifts, so we're keeping the high energy or the high redshift physics unchanged. So you can imagine that the CMB anisotropies are unchanged, they're frozen in, and what's changing here is that we just view them from a different distance, and that changes the association between a physical scale and the last scattering surface and the angle at which we observe it. This decrease in omega lambda, I suppose, would correspond to demagnifying hot and cold spots so that the characteristic size is smaller, or equivalently in harmonic space, the acoustic peaks are just shifted to larger L. A wide variety of experiments before Planck are consistent with a six-parameter cosmological model. So for purposes of this talk, when I say standard cosmological model, I mean a model with the following six parameters. The expansion history is lambda CDM, so it depends on three parameters. I'll use the cosmologist parameterization. H0 is the Hubble rate at redshift zero. The omegas are the fraction of the total energy density in vacuum energy, cold dark matter, baryons, respectively, at redshift zero. This is only three independent parameters since the sum of the omegas is one. The initial perturbations are assumed adiabatic, so they're characterized completely by fluctuations in the scalar quantity zeta, the scalar curvature zeta. So the power spectrum of that initial fluctuation is consistent with being a power law. I'll talk later about where this prediction of a power law can come from. With an amplitude and a spectral index, which are free parameters, the spectral index is defined so that ns equals 1 corresponds to the scale invariant case with an exponent of negative 3, which physically means that if we blow up a subvolume of the initial conditions to the size of a larger volume, then the statistics are unchanged. And the fifth parameter is a nuisance parameter, or at least for cosmologists, a nuisance parameter, which is just how much total reionization has happened. Stars turn on at redshift 10 or so and convert neutral hydrogen back to free protons and electrons. And for observations so far, it's been sufficient to describe this with a single parameter, which can be taken to be either a characteristic redshift of reionization or the total optical depth of the free electrons between now and reionization. Future polarization measurements from Planck will probably need more than one parameter to describe the reionization history. Okay, so that's the standard model. And the way that I see it, the main purpose of Planck is to test this standard model. WMAP pins down the parameters. If we assume the six-parameter model and just take fit the parameters to WMAP data only, that's sufficient to make a very precise prediction for what Planck should see. WMAP's measurements of the first few peaks basically determines the rest of the power spectrum. And the main result for Planck is that we see consistency with the standard model. Up to a small amount of dirty laundry. So there are a few little nagging inconsistencies that one might worry about that I'll talk about. The constraints on the six parameters of the standard model were shown here. Unfortunately, with this projector, you can't really see the yellow curves, which are the Planck constraints. That's unfortunate. I suppose you can see. So in these 1D...
Oh,
that's good. I would like to think that's better, but that would not be an accurate statement. Well, you can look at the 2D plots. So the 1D histograms of each parameter, you can't actually see the Planck constraints on the slide. But in the 2D plots, I think you can tell. So the blue curves are WMAP. The orange regions are 1 or 2 sigma constraints from Planck. So the main difference is there are some shifts of order 1 sigma, so shifts at the expected level. I think it's sort of interesting to dissect what is driving these shifts. So from this figure, you can't tell what part of the power spectrum, for example, is driving the 1 sigma differences between Planck and WMAP. So here's just a little walkthrough of how it works. This is a comparison of the best fit models, not of the actual error bars. The plot just looked a little cleaner that way. Relative to WMAP, Planck wants a little bit less power in the acoustic peaks. But the same level of power in the damping tail. And so to fit that, to make those shifts happen in the six-parameter model, what you can do is if you increase the dark matter energy density, omega matter h squared, that will, if you increase the physical dark matter density, that will decrease the power in the acoustic peaks, but not the damping tail. It will also shift the acoustic scale, the value of L, where you see the peaks. So to compensate and put the peaks back in the correct at the correct value of L, it turns out you want to decrease the Hubble parameter h. The main difference between the Planck and WMAP cosmology is Planck prefers a larger omega matter h squared and a lower value of h. The primordial power spectrum, if we parameterize the size of the fluctuations by a zeta and ns, then the primordial power spectrum is nearly the same in WMAP and Planck. Planck prefers, if you parameterize the amplitude of the fluctuations by a low redshift parameter, say by sigma 8, then it looks like Planck wants larger fluctuations, but that's actually just driven by taking the same size primordial fluctuations and having a larger value of omega matter. I should mention that a real puzzle is that there's an undiagnosed systematic difference between WMAP and Planck, about 2.5% in power, for L's low enough that WMAP measures them with high signal to noise. This level of disagreement is far outside the far outside statistical errors, far outside the quoted systematic uncertainties on calibrations and beams for the two experiments. And so depending on how this is eventually resolved, these parameters will change a little bit. If, for example, Planck has the wrong calibration, then Planck's power spectrum, Planck is low. Planck's measured power spectrum is low than WMAP. And so if that turns out to be a calibration error in Planck, then Planck's best fit values for the primordial amplitude would increase. If it's a calibration error, then we would fit that by just increasing the overall amplitude of the fluctuations, which would drive up Planck's sigma 8, for example.
Are these correlated because of using the same low L polarization? And because doesn't that calibrate with the WMAP polarization?
Not with polarization. With the double, they're both dipole calibrated. You may be thinking of when you do parameter constraints, then measurements of large-scale polarization are very important for breaking the degeneracy between optical depth and size of the fluctuations. But this is just a statement about the measurement of the power spectrum independent of any model.
You don't mean that ALM by ALM Planck is measuring 2.5% less.
That is exactly what I mean. That's right.
So much stronger than a power.
That's right. Just a model independent statement.
Don't Planck and WMAP measure the same frequency? So independent of all the subtractions, couldn't you try to subtract down the difference?
They're not exactly the same frequency, but there's no evidence that this depends on sky location, for example. And it's also that. No. At the CMB, the calibration for each frequency is they're correlated. So that's if it's some global calibration error, that's not surprising.
But you did calibrate with the same dipole, right? I think in the calibration it agrees pretty well.
That's right.
That's right.
So this appears to be just different observations of the size of the CMB fluctuations relative to the size of the dipole. It's a discrepancy at this level is very puzzling. So to explain exactly what I mean when I say that Planck is consistent with the standard cosmological model, to quantify that statement, you need to know what to look for. So what I mean is that if we consider a variety of physically motivated extensions of the standard model. So on all these cases, I'm quoting errors on one parameter extensions of the standard model with Planck data, WMAP polarization, small scale CMB data, and BAOs, just to be totally clear about what's plotted. So we could, for example, in the standard model, the universe is flat, we could add a mean spatial curvature, and Planck's measurement within 2 sigma is consistent with 0. And it's also true for all these other parameters that the standard model's value is in the Planck 2 sigma preferred range. So we can either, just to list them briefly, we can give the neutrinos a mass, a larger mass than the minimal value from neutrino oscillation experiments. We can change the number of neutrino species. We can deviate it from 3. I should explain that what this really measures, when we put a number of neutrino species in cosmology, what we really mean is the energy density at high redshift in relativistic degrees of freedom converted to units of a thermal neutrino. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. We don't see evidence for non-scalar initial conditions for stochastic background of gravity waves. If we parameterize deviation from power spectrum in the initial conditions by a spectral index that runs with k, we don't see evidence for running. A vacuum energy, which is something other than a cosmological constant, or deviations from Gaussian statistics, from the initial conditions not being something more complicated than a Gaussian field. So this is... Yes, everything here is 2 sigma. So as I see it, this is really the main result from Planck. We had a number of windows of opportunity where we shrunk error bars by a factor of 2, say, and we could have seen deviations from the standard model, but we didn't see them. So in the rest of the talk, it would be possible to give a 5-hour talk by elaborating on various details of Planck. So in order to avoid doing that, I'm going to make arbitrary choices. I'm going to elaborate on parts of the analysis that I personally find interesting. The first one is gravitational lensing. So the CMB is gravitationally lensed. When we observe the last scattering surface, we don't observe it through an empty universe. Geodesics are deflected by large-scale potentials. Here is an exaggerated example showing hot and cold spots deflected by a large magnifying lens. We can think of this as combining two fields, the unlensed and unobservable CMB, with a vector field that keeps track of the difference between where we think we're looking on the surface of last scattering and where we are really looking due to gravitational lensing. There is a statistical process called lens reconstruction, which tries to invert the lensing operation. So just by observing the lens CMB, one can certainly imagine that in this exaggerated example, we can infer the existence of a magnifying lens up to some statistical noise. To describe a little bit, to give some intuition for how this works in a non-exaggerated example, if you imagine, consider a large patch of sky, say, 10 square degrees, large enough to contain many hot and cold spots. If this is a magnified, if this region of sky is gravitationally magnified, then if we measure the power spectrum of the CMB restricted to that patch of sky only, we will see a larger hot and cold spots, or equivalently, the power spectrum restricted to this patch of sky will be different from the mean on the whole sky. As shown by the blue curve here, the acoustic peaks will be shifted to lower L. Likewise, if we observe a region of sky which is demagnified, we'll see a local power spectrum which is shifted toward higher L. And so we have a kind of correlation between modes of the lensing potential and the CMB power spectrum. Since the CMB power spectrum is quadratic in the temperature, we're talking about a correlation between one power of the lenses and two powers of the CMB. And one can, given such a correlation, one can write down a quadratic estimator. One can opt of this schematic form with an optimal weighting W that can be worked out, where each mode of the lensing deflections, each Fourier mode, can be constructed by some linear combination or some quadratic combination of modes of the temperature. To give an idea of the size of the effect in a non-exaggerated example, here's a simulation of the unlensed CMB. And I'm going to, in the next slide, I'll show the dramatic difference between this simulation and the lensed CMB. Here it is. So the more you switch back and forth between these, I think the more amazing it is that this actually works. This is a tiny effect. The actual lensing deflections are, the lengths of the vectors are much smaller than the hot and cold spots. They are have a characteristic size of, say, 2 arc minutes. There's another scale, which is the coherence scale of the deflection field. The sizes of the lenses are a few degrees. So it's, if you switch back and forth, it's really hard to believe that this is going to work. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much of a statistic. You would think that there's really no way to tell the difference between these two fields statistically. But in fact, it's true that you can, the quadratic estimators are very powerful, and you can tell the difference. You can reconstruct the lenses with high statistical significance.
What would be the significance for that map? What is the sigma to noise for lensing detection?
In Planck, it's about 25 sigma.
This
doesn't include noise. This simulation doesn't include noise.
Okay.
So let me show you a couple more plots. So this is with Planck noise. So I'm going to switch back and forth between a couple of images that are images of the lensing of the lenses, not of the CMB. In order to plot a scalar quantity, this is the lensing potential phi. So the deflection vector field that I was plotting before is the gradient of this scalar potential. So here's a simulation of a real lensing potential. If I lens the CMB, add Planck noise, this is in simulation, but with the right level of noise for Planck, and do the lens reconstruction, this is what I get. So this map at Planck specs, the lens reconstruction is noise dominated, but there is a high degree of statistical correlation between the two maps that you can see if I toggle back and forth between them. You can see, for example, this near the top of the plot, this blue region is there in both maps. There's statistical correlation that would not be there if they were independent. So Planck is a noise dominated, but still statistically powerful measurement of reconstruction of lensing. Here are some results from Planck data. These are plots of the reconstructed lens potential. The lens potential, by the way, can be written as a line of sight to first order in perturbation theory, can be written as a line of sight integral over the Newtonian potential in the universe times a redshift weighting that peaks at a characteristic redshift of around 2. So these are maps of the largest scale potential wells and hills in our universe, broadly near redshift 2, broadly integrated in redshift, and noisy. There is more noise in these maps than signal by a factor of a few.
You'd have to average over, like, what, 60 degree scales or something to get a signal to noise presumably on larger scales it's more accurate or not?
Well, the scales with the largest signal to noise are around L of, say, 50, corresponding to lenses of a few degrees in size. That's the coherence length of the lenses. Okay, so the power spectrum, this power spectrum plot gives an idea of the overall statistical power. If we square the map from the previous slide, we can estimate its power spectrum. By the way, a more formal way of thinking about this, which is actually maybe more convenient for calculations, is if we think of the lens reconstruction as being quadratic in the temperature, when we square the lens reconstruction to get its power spectrum, we now have a four-point function. Each band power in this plot is a four-point quantity in the original CMB map. And so you can think of this as augmenting the information that's in the power spectrum of the CMB, or the two-point correlation function, with the part of the connected four-point function which is sensitive to gravitational lensing. So this is a 25 sigma measurement of CMB lensing, which is much more powerful than the pre-Planck measurements, and good enough to do precision cosmology with CMB lensing. I'm going to try to inventory all the little glitches and weirdnesses that we see in Planck. So here's the first one, so let me make some general comments. Around L of 600, there's a dip with a statistical significance of 2.5 sigma. When you do a complicated data analysis like Planck that looks at many things, you always get stuck with a few things like this that are always at sort of this, always sort of at the 2.5 sigma level. That's always where you're stuck. One cannot really make definitive statements. It's hard to make definitive statements about whether this is just a statistical fluke. There's about a 1% chance of getting this as a statistical event, which is not crazy, or whether there's something real going on. You don't have the signal to noise, say, if we split this up, if we try to see if it's consistent between frequencies or between different parts of the sky. We only had 2.5 sigma to begin with, so we'll lose all the statistical power when we split it up, unless there's some big, obvious systematic that's revealed. For this particular case, it's hard to imagine that this has the straightforward interpretation of just being, say, a dip in the power spectrum of the matter fluctuations that are sourcing the lenses. For one thing, if you had a dip at a particular k in 3D space, when I did the line of sight integral, that integrates over a variety of redshifts. So a sharp dip in k would spread out and be much broader than this in L. But it could be a statistical fluke. Or it could be, I think it's very plausible that this dip is some real contribution to the CMB four-point function that we don't know about. What this estimator is really doing is just taking the CMB four-point function, which is a sum of all sorts of contributions from various secondaries that are not completely removed from the maps, the KSZ effect, for example, and then trying to pick out the part that's sensitive to gravitational lensing, subtracting all the other stuff that we know about. So if we've missed something, it's possible that there is some reason why some other contribution to the CMB four-point function is maybe showing up accidentally in the part of the lens reconstruction estimator that's looking for lenses at L of 600. I think that's plausible. So we don't really know definitively what's going on here.
Wouldn't you expect anything else to increase the power rather than decrease it?
I think one can make that statement in the limit of a large angular scale in the lenses, much larger than the CMB fluctuations that the lens reconstruction is based on. Mm-hmm. Then you really are sort of looking for large-scale modulation in the small-scale statistics. Any other source of such modulation is likely to add power to the contribution from lensing. But these four-point configurations are you're not really in that collapse limit. The lensing scale is L of 600, and the CMB fluctuations are L of 1,200 to 2,000. So this is really kind of a general four-point configuration that's susceptible to all sorts of accidental contributions.
Is the curve that fits using the Phi as well as the TT? Or is that the curve that you just for the TT?
This is the curve just from TT.
Right.
So yeah. Okay. That's right. The solid curve here is actually not a fit to the points. It's the prediction from the temperature power spectrum.
And what does your modeling for nonlinear effects of the matter power spectrum?
You do nonlinear contributions to the matter power spectrum are important here. I don't remember the exact value of L off the top of my head. It's somewhere, I think, around, say, between 100 and 1,000. But they're included.
But they could be important in maybe that range.
Yes. They are included. Okay, so lensing gives new information. We can now think of the CMB as a measurement of two maps, soon to be three with polarization, the temperature fluctuations, and this lensing map, which is hidden but can be dug out statistically. The constraints from the lensing power spectrum are included in the parameter constraints from previous slides, and they're important. Just to give an example of where they're important, consider the Planck constraints on curvature. If the CMB were not lensed, then one could not separate curvature from turning on curvature from varying omega lambda. Here's a plot. I actually ran CAM with two sets of parameters. I varied omega lambda, and then I turned on curvature, and they both have exactly the same effect. They do nothing at high redshift, but they change the distance, or more properly with curvature, the angular diameter distance to last scattering. So if we take an appropriate linear combination, the two are completely degenerate. And from measuring this curve, we're trying to constrain two quantities with one number, just the value of L where the peaks occur. And we would have a perfect degeneracy in the unlensed CMB. This is shown in this plot. This is a plot of constraints in a parameter space that includes curvature. The colored points don't include information from the lensing four-point function. The reason why you don't have a perfect degeneracy, you can see it cuts off up here, is because there is some lensing information in the two-point function. When we turn on lensing, we break this degeneracy. The error ellipse is still sort of long and skinny. The CMB is much better at constraining this axis than lensing is at constraining this axis. It's no longer a perfect degeneracy, and we can constrain curvature from the CMB. By the way, the reason why these parameters are not degenerate in gravitational lensing is that one can vary these parameters in a degenerate linear combination, which preserves one number, the angular diameter distance to last scattering, but the detailed expansion history and the growth rate of structure is changed. So lensing, which sees the low redshifts and is sensitive to the whole integrated history, can tell the difference. You can also cross-correlate. I want to just talk very briefly about a couple of other lensing-related results that are kind of fun. One can, instead of taking auto power in this reconstruction phi, one can cross-correlate it with various things. The highest signal-to-noise thing is the cosmic infrared background. Planck happens to be a great experiment for measuring the cosmic infrared background, or just total thermal dust emission from submillimeter galaxies at high redshift. This cross-correlation is more than 40 sigma, more statistically significant than the auto power spectrum. One can place strong constraints on things like star formation. There's a lot of modeling involved, but this is a very interesting measurement for behavior of high redshift galaxies. Here's another thing that I personally think is really fun. So there are kinematic special relativistic effects in the CMB that hadn't been seen yet because there wasn't enough statistical power. They have to be there, but I think it's sort of fun to find them. So one thing that's true is that the same Doppler shift that generates a CMB dipole out of the CMB monopole, so that's just multiplying the mean temperature of the CMB, T naught, by a dipole pattern. That applies also. You should also multiply the CMB anisotropy by the same dipole. And that looks like a local change in the power spectrum amplitude. In other words, if we rotate coordinates to point in the direction of the CMB dipole, we should see more power in one half of the sky than the other. That's one effect. That's one special relativistic effect. Another effect is aberration. This is the same effect that says that when you walk in the rain, You see the raindrops is coming instead of straight down, coming toward you. So because you know, V over C is not negligibly small, it's of order 10 to the minus 3, the photons coming, the CMB photons coming in are slightly aberrated. And this actually has the same effect as the big dipole in the lensing potential. So one looks for the aberration with the same lens reconstruction estimator that I already talked about, and the modulation with a closely related quadratic estimator. And you can see it. The combination of these two effects is, with a conservative treatment, I think, of systematic errors detected at 3 sigma and Planck. There's sort of a conceptual point here, which is one can find the statement in the literature, not in the Planck papers, but elsewhere in the literature, that this effect can be used to separate the so-called cosmological and kinematic contributions to the dipole. So the idea is that these special relativistic effects arise because we're moving, and you wouldn't see them if the dipole was not due to our proper motion, but due to a big dipole anisotropy on the last scattering surface itself. So I think this is not correct. What is true is that if you had, say, a purely cosmological dipole, meaning you just had a big dipole fluctuation across our whole Hubble volume, then you could just boost to a coordinate system where you didn't have that dipole, but what you called an observer at rest before is now moving. In other words, the total dipole that we see is the relative velocity of our motion and the surface of last scattering. The separation into a cosmological part and a kinematic part is just a statement about the coordinate system you're using.
Except it might be isocurvature.
Right, that is true. Yeah, the isocurvature case.
Would be
yeah, that's right.
But you have to look for that.
Oh, I haven't actually thought about how one would interpret this result in the presence of isocurvature. Yeah, you need a huge isocurvature mode that's a pure dipole, so it didn't show up in our searches for isocurvature modes in the main part of the power spectrum. Okay, so next I'm going to talk about Planck implications for early universe physics. So let me start by just briefly reviewing, mainly to summarize notation, single field slow roll inflation. So we have an inflationary model for generating the initial conditions. A light scalar, minimally coupled to the metric, in a potential dominated expansion. We need a potential that's flat in order to get many E-foldings of inflation and a roughly scale invariant spectrum, meaning that these two parameters, the first and second derivatives of log V in Planck units, are much smaller than 1. They'll be of order 1 over the number of E-foldings of inflation. Then the following initial conditions are generated. We have scalar perturbations, this power spectrum P zeta. The amplitude of those scalar perturbations is the prefactor here, is the energy density of inflation divided by a slow roll parameter. And that is what we measure. We can say, I mean, assuming that the slow roll single field model is the right model, we can say that we measure this combination of parameters to, say, 1%. The spectral index is also a parameter that's predicted by single field slow roll inflation. We could find this formula for it. There is a stochastic, at some level, a stochastic background of gravity waves. Its amplitude doesn't have the division by the slow roll parameter. So if we parameterize single field slow roll inflation by the tensor scalar ratio, the ratio between these two, then that is proportional to a slow roll parameter. And the deviation from scale invariance is also a linear combination of slow roll parameters. So this parameterization, R and NS, for many purposes, many models of inflation can be constrained just by looking them up on this plot in the RNS plane. So for example, here are the Planck constraints. They're not actually that different from WMAP. The 2 sigma, for purposes of interpreting this plot, I would suggest that you take the blue curves as being the 1 and 2 sigma error ellipses. No, this is Planck. This is only Planck.
What is
Right. Yeah, right, sorry. So this does include the W. Most of the results that I've shown include the WNF low L polarization, which Planck has not analyzed yet. So these constraints are maybe 10 or 20% better than WMAPs. They will get a lot better. Well, the constraint on the y-axis, on the tensor scalar ratio, will get a lot better with polarization because that's not limited by sample variance. But mostly, these measurements are limited by sample variance, and Planck is doing just slightly better than WMAP.
It's a very significant 10
to
20%.
Yeah.
Pi squared is now a deep
problem. Yes, I agree. So it's true that M squared.
All simple inflation models are deep problems.
Well.
R squared doesn't really make any sense.
Yes. Well.
So,
So I would personally not interpret this plot as saying that m squared phi squared is ruled out yet. I think we need, so, that's right, m squared phi squared is here. So it's 2 sigma discrepant with WMAP, which is, well, that's very interesting. I would not say that it's ruled out, I think the exciting thing is that we'll know very soon. The statistical errors on R will get a lot better in the next few years, and that will just tell us for sure.
Can you give us a timescale? When will, if phi squared is wrong, when will it be?
That's a good question. I would guess like less than 2 years. Yeah, either from Planck polarization or from BICEP 2.
That's exciting, because it seems to be not just tensor scalar, but it's other things. I mean, sorry.
That's right.
It looks like one may be able
to. Yeah, I think the R measurement is very exciting. It will happen in the next few years, and it will improve our knowledge a lot. So m squared phi squared is sort of hanging on right on the edge here. Many models are ruled out, like phi to the fourth would be off the top edge of the plot, totally ruled out. The Planck data kind of prefers a potential which is has a smaller second derivative than m squared phi squared. So, say a potential of the form phi to the p with p less than 2.
When they do the model comparison and things and do different ways of treating this rather than just NS and R, the significance of putting phi squared intention increases, doesn't it?
Sorry, say that again?
So this looks, you know, like within 2 sigma phi squared, but with the Bayesian evidence modeling it beyond slow roll, I think that the odds against phi squared kind of increase ever so slightly.
That could be true. I'm not sure.
What's the effect?
It's to do with how they model how they model slow roll.
So
there's a comparison between phi squared.
I mean, it probably has to do with like what prior you choose and
yeah,
little.
Yeah, the priors and the parameterization.
Yeah.
What does it say about the plateau model?
Plateau, I'm not familiar with the term plateau model, but it sounds like you're talking about something with a smaller second derivative than pi squared, which would probably sort of be preferred by this measurement. Yeah, that sounds consistent with, you know, the Planck data wanting a smaller exponent of phi, if you want. But you know, that's
still not really favoring the smaller power law. I mean, the smaller power law is still away from the same.
That's right. Yeah, maybe a power law.
Pointing toward the small power law model.
But then you really, I mean, if we take, for example, the yellow curve is 1 power of phi. It's true that it would be even better if it were in the 1 sigma contour, but it's like 1.2 sigma. That's. It could be, but I don't think one should overinterpret this result. I mean, looking at one sigma, two sigma type effects. I mean, my interpretation of this is that even m squared pi squared is okay, but there's an interesting level of tension here, and it will be really exciting to get better measurements of R to get the polarization. The total number, the reason why these curves are lines rather than points is because the total number of e-foldings between our Hubble scale and reheating is sort of a free parameter.
But this is the number between reheating and us, or is the length of the
interval? Depending on the number of e-folds from reheating, you look at a different place in the inflationary potential to see where you generate the
That's right. The NS and R depend on derivatives of the potential at some point, which corresponds to when our Hubble scales cross the horizon. And exactly where that is on the potential is a free parameter. Yes, that's right. So we can look for deviations, some more things that Planck constrains. We can look for deviations from power law initial conditions. Single field Sorolle inflation predicts that the power law is a good approximation, but if you ask what is the leading deviation from the power law, it looks like this. The exponent of k is a free parameter. This dns over d log k is called the running, and it's a free parameter times log k. Single field Sorolle inflation predicts that this free parameter should be of order 1 over the square of the number of e-foldings, which is too small to be observed different from zero with Planck. Planck finds consistency with zero at 2 sigma. There were some, before Planck, there for some combinations of data sets, you could find negative running preferred at more than 2 sigma. Planck doesn't see evidence for negative running. I suppose it's preferred, but at less than 2 sigma. This preference is driven by the low L's. One of the little glitches in Planck is that at low L, there is less power at about 2 to 2.5 sigma, depending on exactly how you quantify it, than predicted. This is sort of puzzling. I mean, the large angular scales are sort of special, and it's a bit disconcerting that they come out this about 1% low. This could just be a statistical fluke. It's hard to say. There's a more significant dip at L of 1800. You can't really see it in this plot, at L of 1800, there's a feature with a more troubling statistical significance between, say, 2.5 and 3 sigma. This quoted statistical significance includes the obvious look elsewhere effect that this dip could have been anywhere else. Yes. I'm going to talk about primordial non-Gaussianity. This topic is a little depressing for me, a little sensitive, but I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to recover from my trauma and talk about it anyway. All right, so single field slow roll inflation predicts that the initial conditions are a Gaussian field to an incredibly high level of precision. But generally speaking, deviations from the single field slow roll picture tend to show up as predictions for deviation from Gaussian statistics. And this can happen via a lot of different mechanisms. And it's better, I think, to just concentrate on a couple of representative examples than to try to enumerate all the types of primordial non-Gaussianity we can look for. So here's my example, DBI inflation. I'm just going to present this physics very superficially. In DBI inflation, the inflaton is the distance between a D brain and an anti-D brain that are moving together. So at every point in space-time, we have this compactified dimension. It's compactified dimensions. The brain can warp, so over a given point in space-time, the separation is a quantity that can vary from point to point. We can think of that quantity as a scalar field. That scalar field has an effective action, which has this unusual-looking form with a non-standard kinetic term, the dBi square root. A highly non-obvious fact is that if you make certain approximations and appropriately change variables, there's a technical tool that guides this process, the effective field theory of inflation. Then you can end up with making DBI inflation just look like something very standard. The quadratic part of this action is a minimally coupled test scalar field, plus an interaction term. The deviation from the standard kinetic term shows up as this cubic interaction of the form sigma dot cubed with a coupling constant f, which is a free parameter. So we can compute to see what adding this sigma dot cubed interaction would do. We can compute, for example, the three-point correlation function between three Fourier modes of the adiabatic curvature perturbation at the end of inflation. So if you go through the standard QFT procedure, exactly solving the free theory and then using the Feynman diagram expansion for the interaction term, you can write this three-point correlation function. You can evaluate the diagram as an integral over conformal time when the interaction happens. It's a trivial diagram to evaluate. And so the leading prediction to first order in F is that you should see a three-point correlation function at the end of inflation. Higher connected functions, like say a connected four-point function, are proportional to F squared, suppressed, and most of the signal then we expect to be in the three-point function. If you forecast the signal to noise for the three-point function of this form, you will find, if you think of this signal as being a number that's attached to every triangle, closed triangle of momenta, you will find that most of the signal to noise is in equilateral triangles, and so the cosmologist's name for this three-point function is FNL. What I called F before is called FNL equilateral. There's a whole machinery for taking a given three-point function and writing down a three-point estimator in the CMB anisotropy and constraining its amplitude that I'm going to skip and just summarize the results. So for this, these are one sigma errors. For the FNL, for the equilateral FNL that I just described, and a closely related parameter that can also show up in single field inflation called FNL orthogonal, we find consistency with zero at one sigma. This is also true for the so-called local FNL. So these three parameters, I think, are like the big three things that we look for when we look for primordial non-Gaussianity, which naturally arises in multi-field models of inflation. The normalization here is defined so that FNL of order 1 corresponds to deviation from Gaussian statistics at a few parts in 10 to the 5. So constraints in this level mean that the initial conditions are Gaussian to one part in, say, 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4, which is an incredibly precise prediction of, an incredibly precise verification of the prediction of single-field slow-roll inflation. Some other models that I'll just mention briefly. There's something called quasi-single-field inflation. I'm personally kind of a fan of this model. In this model, there's kinetic mixing between the inflaton fluctuations and a second field. Then the second field carries the non-Gaussianity. There's interesting phenomenology when the mass of that field becomes of order Hubble, for example. Anyway, we looked for it and didn't see it. Resonant and transient single field models, if you have an oscillatory potential or, say, a potential with a feature, we look for the associated non-Gaussianity. There are higher spin analogs of the local FNL that you get, if, for example, if you look at solid inflation. In all cases, we find that the associated non-Gaussianity is consistent with zero. A loophole I should mention is that we've only analyzed three-point functions. There are some models that show up in the four-point function before you see them in the three-point function. We've not done that analysis yet. It's much more technically difficult, but we hope to do it in the next set of papers. So I want to just sort of summarize where we stand. So those are the main constraints. Constraints on NS and R, on running, and on non-Gaussianity. And so I just want to give my personal take and where we stand in constraining the physics of the early universe. So the WMAP and Planck constraints, I think, are qualitatively similar. There's a trimming down of parameter space by 20% or so, which is actually quite interesting given that m squared phi squared is special and happens to be right on the edge. The big improvement in Planck is improving the limits on primordial non-Gaussianity. When we do polarization, when Planck does polarization, or when other ground-based experiments release high signal-to-noise polarization measurements, We'll see a big qualitative improvement on R. If you measure the B mode in polarization, there's no sample variance. So you can just keep improving the limit on R as by improving the noise of the experiment until you run into systematics or foregrounds. But there's a lot of room to make constraints on R much, much better. So I would predict that in the next few years, constraints on R will improve by, say, a factor of 10 and may even get a lot better than that. An interesting question to ask that a lot of people in this room have opinions on or maybe even written papers about is the question of whether single field inflation predicts detectable R. It's clear that if you fine tune, you can get any R you want. But if we ask whether generically single field Silverwall inflation gives detectable R, then one can find a couple of perspectives in the literature. One perspective is that if we write R as proportional to a slow roll parameter, then if you write down kind of a generic potential which is flat enough to give 60 E foldings of inflation and deviation from scale invariance consistent with what we see, then there are various ways of quantifying exactly how you choose a generic potential, but in all these formalisms, generically you get R right around the current upper limit. And so this argument suggests that detectable R is the generic case. Undetectably small R is the case where you fine-tune the potential to be flatter than it needed to be. That would be unexpected in single-field slow-roll inflation.
But if that was true, then for instance, when people in string theory were trying to find inflationary models for more complicated potentials in which they often look like a single-field model, it should have been easy to find R to be large.
Right. So another perspective you can find in the literature is that, well, one shouldn't think of the potential. We're trying to replace our ignorance of the correct model by choosing some sort of random, making some sort of random choice. And so we could say maybe the potential isn't the quantity that we should think of as the random thing that we're choosing, but an energy scale of inflation. So if we write the energy scale of inflation, V to the 1/4 to get something with units of energy, that is related to R. It's a small power of R times this dimensional prefactor at around the gut scale. And the point is that inflation, if we think of energy scale as being the parameter that can vary, then detectable R corresponds to, because this exponent is small, detectable R corresponds to a narrow range of energies right near the gut scale, whereas inflation could have happened anywhere to avoid screwing up BBN, say anywhere down to like a TeV. And so generically, if it could be anywhere in this range, then we should get undetectable R. Detectable R is the case where we fine-tune the energy scale of inflation to be right at the gut scale, correspond right to the largest value that it could be, consistent with current data. I know that people in this room have I'm personally kind of agnostic on this question. I think we just need to.
I mean, the safe statement is if you want to avoid this prediction, you have to introduce more parameters.
Yeah,
but
that's
because
models
with
one parameter
are generally
more
stable. Can be proven wrong. Models with two parameters are harder. Three parameters even harder.
That's a very reasonable perspective. I also think that it's hard to make these kind of fine-tuning arguments because the danger is that if one thinks about it too much, one reaches the conclusion that inflation should never have happened in the first place. Inflation is already a fine-tuned theory, and so we're really asking that if we don't allow any extra fine-tuning beyond the fine-tuning that we don't understand that gives inflation in the first place, what happens? So that's maybe kind of an artificial question to be
honest. What's your stand on the multiverse?
That's more of a philosophical question.
To make it more provocative, does Planck support the multiverse picture?
I would certainly say that.
The Planck press conference said it supported inflation, so why didn't they go the whole hog and say, we found results which confirm which lend weight to the multiverse?
Well, I would say it's very hard. It's generally very hard to prove the multiverse right or wrong. I mean, the problem with this sort of Anthropic arguments is that you never know. If you think the Anthropic argument is correct, you never know if you're right or if there's just something that you're missing.
Lenny Sussman always had this argument that if it was a slightly negative curvature, then it would be.
Curvature is constrained to about 1%.
But it's the inflationary multiverse, at least as against Franciscan, does favor negative curvature.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so that's true. The positive curvature would pretty much mean there's no room for a multiverse if you just live on a sphere whose size is not much bigger than our Hubble volume. Yeah. So positive, I guess, most positive curvature can.
Were the limits on K stronger on the positive or negative side?
It's very close to zero, the preferred. Yeah. Okay, so let me just try to go through the last couple slides very quickly. The huge qualitative difference that's going to happen very soon is improving R by a factor of, say, 10 to 100. It's fun to stare at this plot and imagine various scenarios. If we improve the statistics, one could imagine improving the limits on R so that we just zoom in on M squared pi squared. I mean, that would be a really cool result. That would tell us a lot. One could imagine just improving R and just finding upper limits and always finding consistency with zero. I think that would make, well, I'm maybe sort of choosing a side from the argument from a few slides ago, but that would sort of make inflation really seem to be very finely tuned and maybe favor some other mechanism like ekparatic. What it would personally surprise me the most is that if we found a non-zero R but very small, like R of 10 to the minus 3, that would really be, I would personally find that really surprising. The non-Gaussianity constraints from Planck are the big qualitative improvement. It's said throughout the Planck papers that these constraints put pressure on certain families of models. I think that's maybe overstating things a bit. It is true that there was sort of a window. These improved non-Gaussianity constraints represent a window of opportunity where we could have seen new physics. We didn't see it. Really, to rule out qualitative classes of models, I think you have to get to FNL of order 1. Just to take an example, like a model that likes FNL local, like variable reheating or new ekparosis. Really, it's if you got to FNL of order 1 and didn't see it, then in those models you would be fine tuning things, and I think that could be counted as evidence against
them.
But
could
be. could be. But in my view, we had this window of opportunity. We didn't see anything new, and because of that, the Planck picture is really qualitatively unchanged from WMAP. There's some exceptions, by the way, to the statement that you need to get to FNL of order 1 to constrain models from non-Gaussianity. Like here's an interesting example: DBI. You can't have small FNL equilateral and small R at the same time in DBI. This combination of parameters, DBI, by the way, predicts that FNL equilateral is negative. And this combination of parameters has to be larger than a dimensionless constant of order 10. It's potential dependent, so I just left it as order 10 in the slide, times the deviation from scale invariance. Planck allows FNL equilateral around negative 200 and R of around 0.1. So the left-hand side here could be, say, 2. The right-hand side in Planck is, say, 0.4. So DBI is OK, but if you improve the constraints on R much, then DBI, I guess, we'd either get a boost or be ruled out. If you ask the question whether we can get to FNL of order 1 or not, then in the CMB, the answer is no. We're basically limited. We're running out of modes in temperature. When you get out to L past 2,000 or so, they become very non-Gaussian because it's harder to control residual foreground contamination and so on, and so it's hard to use the argument at scale modes in the CMB to look for a primordial non-Gaussianity of order 10 to the minus 4. Polarization, a fantastic E-mode measurement could maybe improve things by root 2, but still won't get you to FNL of order 1. So I think the future for primordial non-Gaussianity is probably large-scale structure. So in large-scale, I'll just briefly summarize. In large-scale structure, some parameters, like the local FNL, can eventually futuristically be constrained to order one or better. Other parameters, like the equilateral and orthogonal FNL, cannot. And so the Planck constraints will probably stand as the ultimate constraints on those parameters. The general statement is that large-scale structure is sensitive to endpoint functions which are large in certain limits that include a small k, either a squeezed correlation function where one of the k's is becoming very small, or a so-called collapsed function where a vector sum of a subset of the k's is becoming small. There are consistency relations for single field inflation that say that these types of correlation functions are always small in single field. So another way to sort of state the conclusions of the slide is that the Planck constraints on self-interactions of the inflaton and single field inflation are unlikely to improve, but large-scale structure can potentially tell us a lot more about models with multiple fields. So in summary, we didn't see primordial non-Gaussianity. We didn't see new physics. And so we have to wait for R to improve to extend our knowledge of the early universe. That should happen very rapidly in the next few years. It'll be really exciting for this measurement. After that, I think we'll be in the regime of slow chipping away at the limits on some FNL parameters, but not all, in large-scale structure. Thanks. One final comment is that there's a third part of this talk that I didn't get to. So if you guys look at all this fun stuff I didn't have time to tell you about. Supernovae, neutrino species, neutrino mass. So if you guys want to talk about any of this stuff, just we can talk about it informally after. Thanks.
Are your statements about FNL, ortho, and equilateral true even if we're able to map the perturbations to 3D with Chime or whatever?
It is true that an even more futuristic possibility is a very good 21 centimeter experiment could potentially be like a super CMB where you have linear theory and the degrees of freedom of a 3D field. And then you could do way better. You could easily get to order one or better in FNL parameters and many other things. Yes, absolutely. But this is the instrumental requirements are really futuristic. In order to be linear in the linear regime, you have to be at redshifts higher than the redshift of reionization. In order to see enough modes, you have to have high signal to noise measurements out to small k. So it's really futuristic, but potentially you could do it. I mean, the CMB is limited. What sets the scale where you run out of modes in CMB is the silk damping scale. The corresponding scale in 21 centimeter is the Jeans scale of the neutral hydrogen. Which is something like a factor of 10 to the 6 smaller than the Hubble scale. So you potentially have like 10 to the 18 modes. And if you think ultra futuristically, 21 centimeter is like an absolutely amazing probe. But it's a little outside my horizon. To me, it just feels too science fiction-y.
So did this 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. I think the way it works is that progress always seems really slow, and then you cross some magic level of instrumental sensitivity, and then it happens really fast. Like that's what's going to happen with R in the next few years.
The large scale structure.
There are a bunch of anomalies in the Planck papers, so which one do you mean? Okay. Yes. So there are
papers out of this.
Right. The question is a question we can ask is there evidence in Planck for a hemispherical power asymmetry for some coordinate system in which there's more power on one side of the sky than the other? And if you look closely at the Planck papers, there are actually three answers to that question. You can look at this. So the hemispherical power hemispherical power asymmetry is included in this analysis of special relativistic effects in the CMB. And so, you know, because of these effects, there is actually a physical and expected hemispherical power asymmetry, which is observed. So this is only half, roughly half of the three sigma. And so if you look for the modulation part on its own without the aberration, you're looking for hemispherical power asymmetry. And that, in this analysis, is seen at about 2 sigma in the expected direction. There's also an analysis which... So according to this analysis, there is no evidence, but besides the expected signal. Yes. Right. Exactly.
No, that's it. It's a different anomaly because this extends to all L's, but the reported anomaly is at that lower, but up to L, but I don't know.
Right. So there is the issue of the L dependence. Are you looking for a power asymmetry which is like the same fractional power difference at all values of L, or do you give it a tilt? Or discussing all the results exhaustive. There is. Yeah, that's right. So there's another, so let me talk, okay, let me just restrict scope to looking for a power asymmetry that is the same at all values of L. There are three analyses in the Planck papers of this. There's this one. There's also the non-Gaussianity parameter that we call tau in L, which is defined totally differently. It's not defined as a hemispherical power asymmetry. And it's not exactly the same thing, but it's about 85% correlated. The tau in L you can think of as a scale invariant field, which is doing the modulation, not a pure dipole. But they turn out to be about 85% correlated because the largest angular scale at L equals 1 just dominates. So the tau in L analysis also does not see power asymmetry after correcting for this effect. If you didn't correct for it, you would see it. You subtract it off, you don't see it. And then there is a third analysis in the Planck isotropy and statistics paper. That shows a power asymmetry when you plot the L dependence out to high L. If you look at the lower subpanel of the upper panel of figure 28 in that paper, then there is a claim that there's a power asymmetry above L of around 1200 of a few percent. Since Planck measures the power spectrum to about 0.1%, that would be very statistically significant, and that result cannot be consistent with these other two analyses.
So is the answer yes or no?
The current state of the Planck papers is that different analyses of this effect are not consistent with each other.
No, yes.
No.
That is the right. So the claimed the third analysis, the one that says yes, finds a different direction. So I suppose subtracting this off wouldn't change anything. But that analysis is just not consistent with the other one.
Are different other directions? Do you compare the ecliptic to the direction of motion? Are they very different?
They're like maybe 60% or so. They're not. In one of the plots in the third analysis, the dipole direction shows up as kind of a subdominant peak. But the main effect is claimed to be in a direction that's pretty different.
But this is not the power asymmetry that people have been talking about for Dapper the math. And Dapper, that's the bigger effect, that's the perceptible effect that I guess is at larger angles, not at the smaller.
I was talking about a power asymmetry that goes out to high L. There are also claims of a power asymmetry at low L, which is using a much smaller number of modes, and this would not show up. That's been around for a while. It's basically the same significance in WMAP as it is in Planck. But there's disagreement about what level of statistical significance you should assign when you take look elsewhere effects into account. We analyzed this in the WMAP 7 papers, and put the statisticals, the probability for a random simulation that you would get a power asymmetry on some scale that's as large as the one seen in WMAP or Planck at around 10%. So my take on that is that it's not particularly statistically significant. The low L part only when you completely include look elsewhere effects.
Okay.